Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm talking with Brian Blanchfield about his latest book, Proxies, Essays Near Knowing. He's a poet as well as an essayist, but these essays are mini-memoirs. They're, well, stories that he tells on himself. I think that I don't know another book that becomes as forward in addressing its reader with all of the things that might be hidden in another writer's work. What made you choose shamelessness as one of the constraints for these essays?
Well, thanks, Michael. I mean, it's such a pleasure to be here. First, I just want to say this is a great honor. I love the show. I listen to it all the time. Yeah, shamelessness. I'm not sure if these are shameful or shameless, or which pole to decide on there. I guess I'll say that in a way, Wayne Kestenbaum and his essaying on humiliation and incorporates autobiography and his own psychology and his own sometimes sexuality and sexual identity. And all aspects of himself is a kind of model. You know, these essays, these 24 essays, I think of as being part cultural studies and part, I've been saying, dicey autobiography. I want to define and unpack the subject at hand. And along the way, I find that I'm also unpacking what's fraught in them for me. And I have a sense of I have almost a kind of heat-seeking sense for the vulnerable terrain inside some of these, some of the territory here, and I do think I wander in and find the naked place and continue to deliver from there, for better or worse.
Well, it's interesting. When I first saw the book, I thought of the short essays that Roland Barthes wrote. Under the title Mythologies. He chose, all kinds of things, Garbo's face or the curlicue of hair Marlon Brando has in the movie of Julius Caesar, to write little essays
about wrestling.
Yes, ways of showing how the culture is revealed in its smallest moments, and eventually it became a model for what he would do with literature and small elements of a text. But Roland Barthes was the first essayist and aesthete that I knew of, living aesthete, who I knew of who had come out as being gay. And it seemed as if this technique, this looking at small things, maybe even insignificant things, trivial things, was a method. Now, as you mentioned, we have Wayne Kestenbaum. We have a lot of writers who are starting to say, all of our lives were lived in the closet, and all the things we loved were despised as trivial. What if we were to say what it is we really love, and what if they are trivial? What if the trivial things are the most important things to us? And so this is a book of beautiful, trivial things that are proxies for deep and true love, yes?
I like that. I think that's a nice way to frame the project. And, you know, and so is what you say about Roland Barthes. I mean, I think maybe it's not unusual to understand a cultural semiotician as also someone who's interested in the ways that queerness manifests in popular culture.
You're a poet, and these essays seem to me to be the essays of a poet. But were you forsaking poetry in order to write them?
Well, you know, in fact, I started writing these as a way to get languaged in the morning, to sort of kickstart myself in a particularly unproductive time as a poet into poetry. So I began writing. I can remember actually when I was living here in Los Angeles, seated on one of the hard carrels at the Los Feliz Public Library, and there wasn't Wi-Fi in there that day. And I decided to write an essay that day on owls. And the sense was that I was going to write what I knew, what little I knew, or remembered, or estimated, or misremembered about that subject, without any access to outside authority, until I had arrived at some sort of revelatory place personally. And that became kind of formulaic. That became determinative of this project. I didn't set out to write a book of essays, and certainly I didn't set out to write a memoir, and didn't know that's what I was doing, teaching myself narrative nonfiction, teaching myself life writing. But I also say that in the process, at age 35 or 36 then, I also found out that I wanted to say what I knew in a way that hadn't been available to me in poetry. And I guess what I mean is, apart from any sort of academic discourse, I wanted to say what I knew as a, quote, queer intellectual poet.
We're talking to Brian Blanchfield. We're about to hear an essay from his book, Proxies. It's an essay called Tumbleweed. Each of these essays has a subtitle, which is Permitting Shame, Error, and Guilt, Myself, the Single Source. Okay, here we go.
On Tumbleweed, Permitting Shame, Error, and Guilt, Myself, the Single Source. Yesterday, a tumbleweed blew right up to my driver's side door at a stoplight here in Tucson. Simpson, westbound, turning onto the highway frontage road north. I was alone at the light. 2 hours prior, a hard decision, I turned down the offer of a 3-year visiting poet position at a prominent creative writing MFA program 1,000 miles away. I got out of the car, chased it a little ways in a subsequent gust, and then fit it into the back seat of my Mitsubishi, where it crumpled a bit in tight captivity. It was my lunch hour. I work a support position at an arts nonprofit downtown, and I brought it home with me. Later, my boyfriend John and I decided we would string it up as a chandelier in our living room. It's December 21st, and we'd been wondering whether we'd get a tree. What does it mean when the universal symbol of itinerancy knocks into you the day you committed to stay a while? The flicker of the firelight will throw the tumbleweed shadow complexly on the ceiling, is my hunch, giving the room a little twirl and flutter. I'll suspend a tiny mirrored disco ball within it, one ornament spinning within another. I want to show it to John even more than I want to see it. When I met John's father, Edmund, when he and his wife Diane, John's mom, visited their son in Montana about this time 2 years ago, his first words to me over the handshake were, "So, visiting poet." I felt it as a challenge, just as 20 minutes later when dinner was over, he'd outwit me to pay the check. He knew I had been John's teacher, and I was uneasy in any misapprehension that our romance began when he was my student. I made sure to narrate the timeline as naturally as I could over our plates of river trout. And it was in that discernible anxiety I felt myself fall farther in Ed's early estimation. Visiting poet is a volatile term, term after term. At Purchase College in 2002, I had my first visiting professor position and was called writer in residence. As I recall, it paid $3,500 to teach a semester of poetry workshop. I rode the subway to the commuter rail at Grand Central to White Plains, where I caught a bus to Purchase to teach my two-hour weekly class. Then at Pratt Institute of Art, I was visiting assistant professor of poetry, which was a designation beneath adjunct and subject to more limiting union restrictions, although I was also advertised as core faculty. I taught two courses per semester and made around $14,000 per year, and learned to collect unemployment in the summers, another $6,000. I visited from a couple neighborhoods away. For two of those 3 years, I lived in an SRO in Park Slope and still needed to supplement teaching income with freelance copy editing work. I moved to Los Angeles in 2006 and taught at both CalArts, where I was visiting faculty, and at Otis College of Art and Design, where I was senior lecturer, essentially an adjunct position, core faculty again. I averaged about $35,000 a year the 2 years I was in L.A. It was the first time I had earned, in thousands, a salary greater than my age. I had worked in publishing before teaching. When I moved to Montana to be Richard Hugo visiting poet, and then subsequently visiting assistant professor of poetry again, I was working less than I had in some time, but was finally officially full-time, also referred to as replacement faculty during those 3 years another poet was on leave. I made some proportion of her salary, the most in my career, $52,000. I rented a whole house. I had insurance. I got therapy. In the last 2 years, I have been the runner-up for tenure-track positions at two universities, Hobart and William Smith Colleges and DePaul University. When the first didn't come through, I took a high school program directorship for $55,000 in Boston, which John and I endured only the 1 year. When I was passed over the second time, we moved to Tucson. We live on the western edge of town, in a sparsely developed area without streetlights, at the foot of the Tucson Mountains, at the immediate margins of the Saguaro National Park. On the other side of Gates Pass, over the closest mountain, down a winding road, is Old Tucson Studios, the most recognizable set of buildings in American cinema and television. Certainly more formative impressions of tumbleweeds originated here than anywhere else. On country radio in those early 80s, Juice Newton sang to the tumbleweed, stretching weed into six syllables on the lilting melody. You're living a cowboy's dream. Freedom is the air you breathe. But you don't stop long enough to let yourself fall in love. When I started teaching at Pratt, it coincided with my breakup with Douglas, my longtime boyfriend in Brooklyn. When I left New York for Los Angeles, I left my ex-boyfriend Brett as well. I left him my apartment, my stereo and records, my bed, my rug. I wrote him letters from my new life. Both breakages were messy and incomplete, compounding the trauma of other separations I had made, wherein I had relied on my career, its demands and opportunities, to structurally necessitate or explain my absence or evacuation from someone or something, never offering the full account of self that would honor that relationship and my own needs, if indeed I understood them. To be in Montana meant separating and finally severing, after the protracted disenchantment of a long-distance partnership, from Doug in L.A. I had thought then that commitment was what I needed to try, but it was and always has been honesty about my own emotions that I owed to him and others before him, and to my grandparents, who are weak, ill, and dying now, an extended family to whom I have never revealed my adult self but have only moved farther away, to the city, to the West, into more remote territories of poetry and the academy, too incompletely realized to judge properly, too far to reject, too busy at Christmas to visit. We have this one secured 6 feet above my head at the moment, suspended by its vestigial stem. The heat blowing from the highest air duct spins the tumbleweed counterclockwise, revolving the little mirror-plated orb within. John has just come in after hours in his studio down the hall to report that in a letter describing his own book project, he talked about time as a vessel for desire. We'd do a small dance, a joint endeavor, before I finish my paragraph, having held my thought or mingling it with another. You writing? He asks.
That was Brian Blanchfield reading his essay, Tumbleweed. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Brian Blanchfield about his latest book, Proxies, Essays Near Knowing, A Reckoning, a collection of 24 single subject essays. By the way, speaking of essays, why not come and join us at a free event? I'm going to be with perhaps the reigning prince of essays, John DeGatta, on Saturday, April 2nd from 6 to 8 at the Los Angeles Contemporary Archive, 2245 East Washington Boulevard, downtown. Come and join us and hear us talk about essays. And if you stay, you'll also hear Brian Blanchfield also speaking about prose writing in the same space. It should be a lot of fun. Okay, now, when you talk about tumbleweed, it's interesting that you are yourself the tumbleweed in this essay, and eventually it's going to be the number of relationships you've left behind. And even your partner's father sees you visiting professor of poetry. What's that? He sees you as a tumbleweed too and wants to protect his son.
Right.
When do you think the status as tumbleweed comes to an end?
When does it come to an end? Well, you know, I don't know. I think it's interesting to follow that analogy because John and I have now for 5 years, we've been together for 5 years, we've been in Tucson for four of those now. So for 4 years, we have, we've strung up a tumbleweed as a chandelier. One always finds us around the holiday season. And now we've decided that it's also important to take the tumbleweed down and to release it in the new year over Gates Pass. And in a way, it's an annual recommitment for us to Tucson. And also to me, maybe it's a commitment to remembering why we moved away from the, in my case, tenure track search as an academic, as a scholar and poet, and made a quote-unquote adult decision to move to a place where we knew we had friends and community and where, for us, there's a wonderful creative life. So maybe the tumbleweed ends appropriately in the desert or continues to roam the terrain there.
These essays stop at nothing. Hmm. And one of the things...
I'm afraid that's true.
That, well, it's wonderful. I mean, it's full of wonderful phrases, great surprises, but one of the things it's not full of, it's not full of BS. You want to tell the truth, and so you tell us how little you earned at different teaching jobs. And so often, we know so many people who teach and write and teach and write and teach and write and make very little money out of either. And so many people teach and write, but unless you're very successful, you don't earn adult salaries. And I'm talking about the America of our time, in which there's next to nothing that an intellectual or a poet or an artist or a dancer can do except be successful. This has a terrible effect on the arts in our country, huh?
I think so. You know, these essays explore in a rather disinhibited fashion sex and sexuality and a certain amount of family fallout and a certain amount of my upbringing in Primitive Baptist, Central Piedmont working class, North Carolina. But I think the taboo that I transgressed the most, judging from reactions that I'm getting here in the early days of this book, is in naming names and naming salaries and numbering salaries in academia and talking about hiring practices and that sort of thing. And I felt like that was a part of my life, and that's a part of what I wanted to be candid about. If I'm being candid in these other areas, I wanted to risk a certain amount of career shame and speak from my experience about, you know, what is precarity, what is the gig economy.
Well, the book pleased me because, as opposed to facts, it offers phrases. The phrases are often beautiful. You mention at one point that one of the indexes of being a slut is being a person who hurries home in jizzy jeans. And you're not going to find such beautiful alliteration in many places. The essays here are essays by a poet who is examining his own sluttiness from time to time, and everyone else's as well. And the book is full of, I don't know, a surprising and titillating sexual impulse. It's a poke in the ribs. You want the reader to say, I'm not going to be a good boy or girl. I'm going to read these essays to find out what people don't talk about.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's an unexpected pleasure to hear you say that line. That was a treat for me. But I think there's, you know, in the cumbersome formulaic subtitles, permitting shame, error, and guilt, for me, the active word is permitting. I mean, I hope that these essays are in a way permissive. And they certainly were a way for me to trick myself and draw myself out into an uninhibited space. I mean, that is not at all my own demeanor. Do you know? I mean, I'm not an uninhibited person.
And yes, so, it's very interesting. You repeatedly say that you are withdrawn. Although, and I don't know you very well, although you lived here in Los Angeles for a few years, but it's hard to believe that you're withdrawn given how straightforward, well, maybe not straightforward, given how forward you are in these essays.
Yeah, you know, I like what you said about parlaying what we don't always know about one another's lives and career lives and sex lives. You know, the essay that was excerpted and published in Harper's this fall was on frottage, and it's a study of that sex act. You know, it begins with an accurate and certainly rather thorough description of what frottage is for men, and a speculation about what it is for women, and it's not discussed often, and it ended up being a way for me to talk about growing up under the specter of HIV and AIDS and arriving in New York in 1996, right about the time, though no one knew it then, of the cocktail and AZT and a way to survive the virus and the disease. It was also the year in which the most people died from the disease in New York City. So in talking about what I was given to in my predilections and the way I was sort of inscribed by the epidemic I grew up with, I hope to be giving voice maybe to other people in my generation and being honest about a whole number of practices, including community building and solidarity and caretaking one another, that that we were doing in the late 90s in New York. And I think in a way there's, we're just at a moment when people are beginning to speak about that and to historicize that.
Well, so are you saying in part that AIDS led to a new requirement that there might be less demanding sexual acts, but more demanding truth about sexuality? In other words, to be safe required a lot of honesty, a lot of truthfulness with one's partners, and a lot of change in the nature of the acts themselves, which leads a writer to a change in the nature of writing.
Yeah, you know, I might fuss with the word demanding there, but I do think that it was worth investigating. Once I sort of got into what the act was and to remembering how many people said to me or I said to him, we don't have to do anything, and what that meant, what that might have meant, what anything was, what the question of simulation of heterosexual sex, what that was, how that was inscribed in such a remark, what anything might have been, and the permission, quote, not to do anything, was a way to say, I see you, we're together, I'm one of you, we're okay.
I've been talking to Brian Blanchfield, the author of Proxies. There are two subtitles, Essays Near Knowing and A Reckoning. I would like to say it's a book that I felt lucky to be reading. It's a book that kept revealing to me the number of personal things that I didn't know I had not yet said. It opened all sorts of doors for conversation for me. And thank you for joining me.
That's a lovely thing to say. Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Proxies, Essays Near Knowing, A Reckoning at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Greg Jackson is our guest.
I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.